Pittsfield.
All right, we're back. Let's give a nice warm Radio Vermont welcome this morning to Robert Appel. Robert was the executive director of the Human Rights Commission before he went private, shall we say. He's now working in a private law firm, but he wrote this very interesting, I'll use the word interesting, piece over the weekend that talked about police shootings, and he's here to join us to talk about it a little bit more. Robert, good morning. How's
good morning,
it going?
Mark. It's going well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're in private practice where?
I'm a partner in the law firm of Cohn, Rath, Dannon, and Appel in the beautiful downtown village of Hinesburg.
All right. This piece you wrote over the weekend talked about what's been happening in Ferguson, also in New York. In the police shootings, why did you feel compelled to write about this?
Well, as you know, my career in state government, which spans 35 years, was really focused in a combination between criminal defense and civil rights enforcement.
Because you were a public defender.
I was defender general, ran the public defender systems in the 90s. And then from 2001 to 2012, I was executive director of the Human Rights Commission. So it's certainly been an issue throughout my career. It's essentially why I became a lawyer. I'm a non-traditional lawyer. I didn't go to law school. I came to law to promote social, racial, and economic justice. So, and it's not just Ferguson, Cleveland, Staten Island. It's everywhere. I mean, that's really the point of my piece. It's, you know, Vermont's a wonderful place. I heard you and Betsy talking about it. I love Vermont. I'm very grateful to Vermont for the opportunities it's given me. It's a wonderful place to raise a family. I have two grown young men. But it's no different from the rest of the world. And unfortunately, and, you know, our governor's famous for this, is promoting the notion of Vermont exceptionalism. And Vermont is exceptional in many, many ways. It's not exceptional when it comes to being free of racism and unequal justice. And my piece, I want to be clear that I greatly value and respect the work that law enforcement does. It's a very challenging job. We need good policing. But as I like to say, it's like any other profession. There's a bell curve of people who do an excellent job, people who do okay, and then people who probably shouldn't be in that field. Mm-hmm. And my concern is, how do we move the curve forward? How do we get past the, as I say in the article, and it's the literature is now replete with references to implicit bias. It's not the days of Bull Connor. It's not the days of, lynching. We're past the overt, by and large, past the overt racism and brutal racist attacks that our history, unfortunately, is built upon. What we face now is, you look inside of each and every one of us, you and me included, we have our preconceived notions by how people look, how they're going to behave. And police officers are no different from the rest of us. Judges are no different from the rest of us. Prosecutors, defense attorneys, you know, we all have it. So the challenge becomes, how do we unearth that? How do we get in touch with it? And how do we essentially compartmentalize it so we don't allow it to influence our actions? That, you know, police officers are trained to observe objective behaviors that give rise to articulable suspicion of criminal conduct. That's the term of art. And unfortunately, we still see instances where skin color substitutes for articulable suspicion here in Vermont and everywhere. Mm-hmm. So
talk about some of these numbers, though. You talk about what the prison population is here in Vermont. You talk about the likelihood of getting stopped.
Well, those numbers are not particularly new. They've gotten worse over time. Our entire set of numbers have gotten worse over time. Let me just start with that. When I became Defender General in 1993, we had something like 500 people incarcerated. Now the number is 2,600, which is incredible growth. And again, we're not different from the United States. United States per capita imprisons more people than any country in the world, I believe, except Russia and China.
I think we're higher than China, believe it or not.
We have 2.3 million people in custody.
Per capita. Mm-hmm.
Okay. At a cost that is phenomenal. In 1993, the corrections budget was $27 million. Today, it's well over $100 million in the state of Vermont. We spend way more than we do on higher education on corrections. You know, we're spending 40, 50 women, 60,000 a year to put people in cages. For relatively minor, nonviolent crimes all too often. So in that growth spurt, we've seen a doubling of the racial disparities. Back 20 years ago, prison population was about 5% people of color. Now it's 10%. Why is that? There's a lot of different theses or, you know, explanations that are offered. And I can't argue that some of that growth is not the result of young men of color, particularly men, coming north with drugs of all sorts of variety, heroin in particular, street drugs, cocaine in the day. But the question then becomes, is it only black people who are coming north with these goods? Probably not. Is it more likely for a black person who's trafficking in drugs to be picked up in Vermont than a white person? Probably so. Just because we're not used to seeing black people in the numbers that you would see in Connecticut, Massachusetts, New York, you know, wherever. I lived for many years in Woodbury and Hardwick, Vermont. I just moved over towards where I work. I know you're a Burlingtonian. You've seen the change in our demographics in Chittenden County. The Northeast Kingdom, you still don't see people of color on a daily basis. When I first moved to Vermont, I didn't see a person of color for a month at a time. My neighbor, who was a good local Vermonter, very good man, said he did not meet a person of color until he joined the Army. You know, this was 1970. So, and our local storekeep referred to black people as spear chuckers without any reservation or embarrassment.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, things have certainly changed. There has been an influx of refugees from around the world. Initially, it was Southeast Asians in the 80s and early 90s, and now it's, you know, then it was Eastern Europeans.
Africans. Somali.
And now it's Africans. Now mm-hmm. it's Somalis. Now it's Congolese. It's also Bhutanese and people from Asia. But in terms of numbers, one in three students in Burlington is now a student of color. You know, you have a child in the Burlington schools.
You're one out of three?
One out of three.
And students in university students?
No.
Okay, say that again.
Burlington School District.
Okay.
Burlington
okay.
School District. And the two schools in the Old North End, Sustainability Academy and Arts, the Arts, I can never get the name right. Arts Academy is more like one and two.
Right.
So certainly the demographics have changed. Does it support the gross numbers we see in corrections? Well, if you're only looking, you know, if law enforcement is paying closer attention to people of color than there are white people, you're going to see a higher rate of black people getting arrested, charged, prosecuted, and convicted. And at the same time, it basically gives people that look like you and me a pass. You know, the attention is not focused on white folks because we're not seen as suspicious. We're seen as fitting in the environment. As a friend of mine who teaches at the University of Vermont, Rashad Shabazz, talks about black faces in white places. So, you know, just your mere presence sort of perks things up. One thing I did... Many things I've learned doing this work, but one of the most important was through this organization called the Uncommon Alliance that was active 5 to 8 years ago, where four police agencies in Chittenden County voluntarily agreed to collect race data on motor vehicle stops.
Mm-hmm.
And in that work, and this was from Chief Sherling, Mike Sherling, it dawned on me that and I reference this in the article, that police agencies unfortunately often become the instrumentality of community racism. So if, a person in the community who has not had a lot of contact with minority populations sees three teenage boys hanging out in the park with baggy pants and their hats on sideways, standing around talking, they may call the police. Now, where's their articulable suspicion of criminal activity? Well, they're black, they got baggy pants, and their hats are on sideways. In the old days, Burlington would send a car out. Now they're asking for a description from the community as to what exactly are they doing that gives rise to your belief they're breaking the law.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that's a step forward. That's the kind of work I'm talking about,
mm-hmm.
that we need to educate both the community and law enforcement to play by the rules, essentially.
We're talking with Robert Appel. He was the former executive director of the Vermont Human Rights Commission, now in private practice, wrote a piece over the weekend talking about police bias. You say in this piece, Robert...
Well, let me just add, it's not just what? Police bias. It's all of our bias. But police are in a position where they have the ability to act on it and create these gross disparities.
Okay, that's what the piece was about, though.
Right. True.
Okay. I mean, I'm willing to admit we all have bias.
Right.
But, you know, when I say that the piece was about the police, that's accurate.
It is accurate.
Okay. You say here, unfortunately, it's only a matter of time until we, too, suffer the divisive tragedy of a white police officer shooting and killing a young African-American male. What do you base that on?
History, as a predictor of the future, the changing demographics, unfortunately, we've had a substantial number of police shootings, including fatalities, increasing numbers. Intuitively, I don't have the data. I mean, as I reflect back, it seems more and more often that one reads of police shooting a suspect. Again, with the changing demographics, unless we bend the curve in terms of having police act solely on legitimate indicators of criminal activity, we're going to have these poor interactions between citizens and police officers. And given the increased number of young men of color, it's speculation, but my point, and it is provocative, I understand that, my point in making that statement is to say that Vermont is no different from the rest of the world. Not different from the, statistically from the United States. It's just been a rash in the last several months between Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, Tamir Rice, I believe was the name of the 12-year-old shot dead in Cleveland, Trayvon Martin, which wasn't a police shooting, but it's similar in nature. And those are the ones who get the publicity. It's not an uncommon event. Unfortunately, then we have what happened over the weekend in Brooklyn, which is even more, in many ways, more tragic.
Mm-hmm.
And my heart goes out to the families of the officers involved. I mean, there's just no way to justify that act. I mean, it was an act of a crazy person. And ironically, the two officers shot were
right.
Apparently a Chinese-American and a right. Latino man.
Right.
It's just senseless.
But let me ask you this. Is race really the issue? Because as you point out in this piece, there have been a number of people in Vermont that have been killed by police officers. They've been white.
Right.
And there's no action done by the Attorney General, which you're critical of in this
yes.
piece. So doesn't that mean that's really more of an issue with authority and the police, and white and black is not really the issue?
I think the fact that police are not held to the accountable and held to standards similar to you and me feeds that. It's another factor that intersects with the race, that if police feel, I won't say comfortable, but... more likely to go to lethal force than the situation warrants, knowing that historically they've not been held to account, I think that makes it easier for them to reach for service weapon rather than pepper spray or even a taser. And we can get into tasers at another time. I do. Some people think tasers are torture instruments and have no reasonable use. I'm not one of them. I think tasers have a proper place in a continuum of force. Now, the question again is the force reasonable under the circumstances that the officer's facing? And, you know, I understand 2020 hindsight is wonderful, and officers are put in a very difficult spot when they're on the street and confronting out-of-control behavior. But at the same time, we cannot give license to excessive use of force.
Maybe put those white headphones on over there.
White
244-1777, toll-free. They're gray, actually, I should say. Because not
everything's gray.
Not everything's black and white, right?
No,
Robert?
Everything's gray, yeah. As you can tell from this conversation.
All right, let's go to Braintree. Gordon, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning,
interesting
Gordon.
Discussion, and I have a few comments about racism as a white person, but I was brought up with the civil rights movement. I think I told you once I went to Washington and saw Martin Luther King give his famous speech. That doesn't mean I've done anything to help black people or end racism. But I do see since that age that in many ways racism has been culturally kind of exterminated. But now it's come back in a form of kind of cultural warfare, which what I think it is, like, which creates images of young black men as and ideals for them as in this thug hip-hop culture kind of thing. So that, you know, you hear about police shooting young black men, and you hear, you know, there's black police will shoot young black men. Mm-hmm. It's not so much about race as it is. Well, I think it's not so much about race as an identity thing that's been created to keep the black communities and others in their place in the absence of institutionalized official racism. And I don't like the idea of this inevitability of any bad thing. Maybe it is, but just to say this is going to happen. Well, it's like the riots in Missouri. I mean, those were known, you know, you knew that was going to happen. And the way that the grand jury made its announcement, just at the right time to start riots, and the way the news continuously, we hear about, well, a young black man and a white cop, and they don't mention other shootings. You know, they've just been emphasizing this black and white thing, which to me is about polarization and creating more polarization and fear and distrust.
Okay. All right, I think we got it. Let me have Robert comment. Thank you, Gordon.
Gordon, thanks. You raised a number of issues there. The media's demonization of young black men, I think, is a component of this, and young black men adhering to the gangster hip-hop presentation as a way of proving themselves to be, you know, virile men, I think is a component of the problem. There's a very interesting book written called The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, who talks a lot about, she talks a lot about the growth of the prison industrial complex and how it's overwhelmingly designed to control this excess labor force that we now have, particularly in inner cities. When we were a manufacturing culture, people had jobs. Now all those jobs seem to be in low-wage places in the third world, be it, Indonesia or Mexico or Brazil. So you have this excess labor force that's predominantly minority that have very little economic opportunity. And an economic opportunity is certainly presented by the black market and drugs. So, you know, I think there's an institutional component where we're not providing equal opportunity to all of our population. I just finished a very interesting book by Tavis Smiley called Death of a King, which mm-hmm. was about Dr. King's last year on the planet. and his push for the Poor People's Campaign that didn't happen because he was gunned down in Memphis. And it was all about his connection of militarism, poverty, and racism as destructive of the American culture. And I think, you know, here we are, what, almost 50 years later, and one can say the same thing. You look at who goes in the military, it tends to be probably, you know, again, intuitively, I don't have the numbers, but it seems to be poorer people, more likely black and brown, because that's an economic opportunity. And the fact that we no longer have a draft and really takes away the feeling of the militarization for the middle class, we've not been as anti-war as we were when you and I were teenagers. So a lot of this is a repeat of history. I guess I'll stop there.
What do you hope to accomplish with this piece?
Get people to think. And that's why I chose to write about it. Get people to look at what's going on in our own communities. I can't help but think of the Burlington School District and the problems they're going through. There was a protest several springs ago by students of color because they felt they were not being educated in the same way that dominant culture students were. The ELL, the English language learning component, was sort of segregated off to the side, and students were saying they weren't getting a fair shake. There's numbers that show that students of color in Burlington are disproportionately disciplined at a harsher level. You'll be hearing more about that after the first of the year. Legal Aid's putting out a report with a lot of data on that. And at the same time, the school district is in substantial financial problems, and there's now talk of eliminating the diversity and equity office, which took years of struggle to create. So, which I think would be a dramatic mistake. You know, and again, you know, it's, when I talk about general bias, you know, I did speak about police, but I think teachers have it. I think administrators have it. You know, unfortunately, the stereotype, you know, people cross the street when they see a young black man walking on the sidewalk wearing a hoodie. Now, what does that signify? It's generalized irrational fear. How do we get beyond that? I think we have to think and talk. And that's really what this piece was designed to do, is to make people think and talk. And a lot of that's happened over the past 3-4 months. With these tragedies and the lack of response by the judicial system. And I have to, and as the article says, I have to place a lot of that blame on, in my view, the misuse of grand jury systems, that prosecutors are not, they're sort of, I forget the guy's name in Ferguson, but it was pretty clear he just dumped the evidence and made no argument, which is generally not how the grand jury system works.
Mm-hmm.
You've heard the adage that you can indict a ham sandwich. I mean, what did I hear? It's out of 162,000 grand juries, less than 100 came back with no indictments.
Right.
So what does that tell us?
Let's go to Cabot. Tony, good morning.
Good morning. It's good to know that your guest has a crystal ball when it comes to what police are going to do.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but I understand your comment.
And I find it offensive, and I'm just really angry that someone would cast those kinds of aspersions on the police.
Why are you angry about that? I mean, he's laying out what numbers here that population is.
A lot of time he says that. Well, I don't know what the numbers are, so I don't think he has the numbers in as far as.
Well, there's no question there's a growing population of non-whites in this state. I don't think anybody could argue that.
But those aren't the numbers that I'm talking about, though.
Okay. What numbers?
The other thing he says is, well, this kind of thing, this kind of leads to police making them feel more freely about taking their weapons and shooting someone. Where is this coming from?
All right. Let me have Robert talk about that. Thank you, Tony.
Well, it comes from reading reports in the newspaper. It comes from, an increased militarization of police. I don't know if you followed this, but there's a lot of surplus military weapons coming to police agencies without much, if any, public input. One thing I frequently speak about when I talk about this issue is the Vermont Constitution in Chapter 1, Article 5, it's quite clear that internal police are to be governed by the people. Right now, there is no regulation or governance around procurement of these weapons. I think that was part of the problem that escalated the conflict in Ferguson, was when the police came out and these armored personnel carriers. You know, to me, and again, I have great respect for the work police do, and I don't mean to denigrate the work, but I think what we need to think of officers as being are peace officers, not to maintain the peace rather than to control in all manners conduct of citizens.
Let me take one more call here. Let's go to Waitsfield. Peter, good morning. How are you today?
Good morning, Mark. Good morning, Robert. I wonder what Martin Luther King would have to say today about the war on drugs if he were alive. One of the earlier callers mentioned the baggy pants in the hip-hop community. The roots of that come from oversized prison jumpsuits.
Sure.
And the young black hip-hop community adopted that as a clothing style. A couple of shocking statistics. One is the United States today has more black men under the supervision of the criminal justice system than were enslaved in 1860. And a large reason for that is for this ridiculous, irrational, counterproductive, expensive, dangerous drug war. And another statistic that supports this is that the United States locks up more people for nonviolent drug offenses than Europe locks up for all crimes combined. We far, by any other country, we incarcerate our neighbors at a greater rate. And these are our citizens, our sons, our daughters. And by the way, a lot of families are being destroyed by this policy as well. And this, I hope, is the beginning of a long discussion.
Thank you for your call.
Not only are families being devastated, but financially we're being bankrupt. I appreciate the sentiment on numbers. Yeah, data repeatedly shows that 1 in 3 African-American men under the age of 30 are either in jail or under correction supervision nationwide, which is an astounding number. I believe 42% of people on death row are black men, where the black population is in the high teens. So, and it tends to be, you get sentenced to death more frequently if you're a black perpetrator with a white victim. So racism, unfortunately, is infused throughout our entire criminal justice so-called system. I don't really see it as much of a system, but it's sort of disjointed. You know, it is a means of carrying out our history and our societal view of race, unfortunately. And as I like to often say, we have much, much work yet to do.
This is FM 96.1 WDEV Warren, AM 550 WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier. Let's go to Berrytown. Xenia, good morning.
Good morning, Mark. Hi, Robert.
Good morning, Xenia.
Of course, there's another group of devalued people in Vermont and elsewhere who have been shot by police, often fatally. And I think you both know the population I'm thinking of. How about a slogan that says, "Crazy Lives Matter"?
Yeah. Xenia, you know, I can't agree more with you. A lot of my work in criminal justice has been around trying to destigmatize those who don't conform due to mental health issues.
You've been very good about that, even when lots of other people who you'd think would be right there on that rights issue haven't been. You've been very good all along.
Well, I appreciate that, Senior. Again, it's stereotypical thinking that danger, different equals danger, whether it be African American, be it people who look or act a little differently. Again, law enforcement is supposed to act on objective evidence of potential criminal wrongdoing, not how somebody looks, not how somebody acts, unless that act crosses a line into criminal conduct.
The sad thing about it is that unrealistic, negative stereotypes about people with mental health issues becomes the exoneration principle, in that police who have fatally and otherwise shot people with mental health issues say, well, I was genuinely afraid for my life. And, well, if somebody has all these stereotypes that people are violent and so forth, the inaccurate stereotypes become an exonerator. If you're terribly, terribly afraid of crazy people, then your shooting was justified.
And again, as Xenia, as you know, there has been much work done within law enforcement to try to break down those stereotypical thoughts and give officers greater skill in how to proactively engage with people in mental health crisis and de-escalate rather than heighten the tension, and to bring in, whenever possible, people whose life work is dealing with people with psychiatric issues. So, again, I see that as a positive step. Vermont has been on a good path in that regard. Could we do it more quickly and more intensively? Sure, but at least we are walking down that path. We're doing the same with race, but in my view, a little slower.
We'll get back to our discussion with Robert Appel in just a moment. We head to Washington, D.C. Joining us live on the line this morning from Talk Radio News Service, here's Victoria Jones. Good morning, Victoria.
Hello.
How's it going? What's going on this week?
Going okay, thank you.
All right. What's going on?
Well, a lot of people here are also talking about the shooting in New York City. They're also talking about North Korea and Washington's response to North Korea over the Sony hack, and also a little bit about Cuba. They're also talking about gas prices being the lowest since May 2009.
Mm-hmm. What's the president said about the shooting in New York, if anything?
The president condemned it unequivocally, saying two brave men won't be going home to their loved ones tonight, and for that there is no justification. Excuse me. He said that that this is just a partial part of his statement. It was a strong, quite emotional statement. He also asked for a rejection of violence and words that harm, and he said that people should instead turn to words that heal, including prayer and patient dialogue. And Attorney General Eric Holder said in the statement that it was an act of unspeakable barbarism, and said he was deeply saddened to hear of the loss of these two brave officers in the line of duty, and said he was speaking on behalf of all those in the Department of Justice. And the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, went to Brooklyn on Sunday and visited the precinct where the two officers served.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What has been the response to North Korea?
Well, a couple of things. A great deal we don't know, partly because President Obama has asked Cyber Command, which is commanded also, incidentally, by the head of the CIA, who used to be just the head of Cyber Command and now also is head of the CIA. He's asked Cyber Command to come up with a range of options for him. But he says that he's going to review whether to return North Korea to the list of state sponsors of terrorism. President George W. Bush took them off that list. he said, we don't make those judgments, returning them just based on the news of the day. He says he doesn't consider the attack an act of war. He said, I think it was an act of cyber vandalism that was very costly, very expensive. We take it very seriously, saying the U.S. will respond proportionately. Now, if you call something an act of war, you have to take a certain response to that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a reason why he's not calling it an act of war.
Right.
The Obama administration has sought China's help in recent days in blocking North Korea's ability to launch cyber attacks. And it's not clear what China has said. Secretary of State John Kerry had a phone call yesterday with Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi. They did discuss cyber attacks, cyber terrorism, and the attack on Sony. But a statement from the Chinese Foreign Ministry does not mention North Korea. But that doesn't mean it wasn't discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's quite possible that one of the things that they're looking at doing is financial sanctions, and the U.S. is considering that. They're under probably the heaviest sanctions on earth of any country anywhere. But the one sanction that in the last 10 years that's really caused the most pain to the North Korean leadership, interestingly, was the freezing of its accounts at a small bank in Macau,
mm-hmm.
which the leadership used to buy luxury goods.
Right.
And also they used that money to flee North Korea if they needed to get out of the country.
Yeah, well-known laundering spot.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, anything else you want to mention?
Yes, Bo Bergdahl. The report of Sergeant Bo Bergdahl is from the U.S. Army is expected to be announced today, that it's forwarded the results of its investigation into his 2009 disappearance from an Afghan outpost. But we are not expected to hear what the results are today. And in other words, they are expected to have found that he acted improperly in leaving his post, but they're not saying the exact nature of the infraction or what the punishment's going to be.
Mm, okay. All right. Thank you, my friend. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Victoria Jones works at Talk Radio News Service out of Washington, D.C. Back to our discussion. We've been talking with Robert Appel about a piece he wrote over the weekend talking about police bias and police shootings. Let's head to Moncton Ridge. Fred, good morning.
Good morning. I think the problem lies in one place. It lies in how we hire policemen. Policemen hire of like ilk. So what we do in every community across the country is we have a citizen board with some police on it, local members of the community. When somebody applies to be a member of the police force, we decide as the council if they're going to be a policeman, a fireman, an EMT, what kind of disposition does that they have, where does it fit the best in our links as a community? You just can't believe how many police think like each other, and they hire the same. And if we stop that, I think we could stop this progression of white males across the country looking down at everybody else. I just really believe that this is a quick fix.
All right, let me give Robert a comment. Thank you, Fred.
Fred, it's an interesting observation. I do know that certain departments in the state employ citizen panels and have interviews with prospective candidates to check their disposition, to see how they do fit with the community norms. Again, I'm now going to quote the Constitution. Article 5 says that the people of the state, by their legal representatives, have the sole, inherent, and exclusive right of governing and regulating the internal police of the same. So I agree that police agencies should reflect both the morals, the mores, and, you know, the makeup of the community. It is a challenge. where you have low minority populations to get qualified applicants to take on the challenging work of being a police officer. For years, the Vermont Criminal Justice Training Council has done screenings that are supposed to ferret out people who don't well fit into police work. One of the earliest cases I had when I was an investigator in the Civil Rights Division of the Attorney General's Office in the early 80s was a challenge to the use by the Criminal Justice Training Council of the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory as a screening device for officers. Now, the Minnesota inventory is based on the cultural mores and norms of Minnesota right. in the 70s, which was primarily
pretty white. Yeah,
not anymore.
Okay,
but Twin Cities
but was
yeah. So it had research had shown that it had a disproportionate impact on African American candidates, including a fellow who applied and was found not qualified. Brian Searles was then the chief of the training council. We were able to work our way through it, and they abandoned that approach. So if you're going to screen, you have to use valid tools. You have to use, evidence-based, non-biased tools, which are hard to come by. I think your notion of hiring like is accurate. I think the Training Academy has done a better job over the years in preparing new officers to deal in a more multicultural environment. Domestic assault trainings were compelled by the legislature 20 years ago. Prior to that, they really didn't happen at the academy. And it was primarily, state police at one point were under a consent decree to hire more women from the Department of Justice. This is back 20 years. And they're doing better. But I think you're right in saying unless you broaden the base and have diverse cultures and respect for diverse cultures in an institution, you're going to continue to have the same sorts of problems. And that's one of the reasons that I and others have pushed very strongly on the use of race data collection and motor vehicle stops as a way to ferret out those sort of biases. One of the purposes of writing this piece was to point out that this data has been collected for a number of years, but is sitting unanalyzed, purportedly for a lack of money. To me, it's a very wise investment to get that data collected and analyzed and used. Collecting it and not analyzing it, to me, is a great disservice. It's saying you're doing something when you're really not. Last year, the legislature, in a bill around eyewitness identification, now requires all departments to collect the data, but there's no requirement that it be amalgamated and analyzed. That's the next step.
We'll take a quick break. We'll come back and continue our discussion right after these important announcements.
WDEV presents Midnight Mass live from St. Andrew's Catholic Church in Waterbury, starting with a choral prelude Christmas Eve. Midnight Mass on WDEV is a presentation of the Knights of Columbus Council 2085. All proceeds from this broadcast will be collected by the Knights of Columbus for their charity fund. Midnight Mass is underwritten in part by Stowe Street Emporium on Stowe Street in Waterbury, Perkins Parker Funeral Home on South Main Street in Waterbury, Blue Flame Gas serving Waterbury, Barry, and Morrisville, Arvad's Grill on Main Street in Waterbury, Billings Mobile on Route 100 in Waterbury, Horns Energy serving Washington and Lamoille counties, Duxbury Auto Tech on Main Street in Duxbury, Waterbury Pharmacy on South Main Street in Waterbury, Waterbury Service Center on South Main Street in Waterbury, and Waterbury True Value on Route 100 in Waterbury, Zachary's Pizza on Butler Street in Waterbury, Waterbury Center Auto Repair, Howard Avenue in Waterbury Center, Cold Hollow.